Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. Joining me in the studios of CBS Interactive is my co-host, Fleischman Hillard's VP of Digital Media, Scott Rohde.
Hi, Tim.
And today's guest, Clemenger Group Executive Director, Tim Parker.
Hi, Tim. Good to be here.
This week, the stakes get higher in radio giveaways. Han Superdry's lucky bottle promo. Vodafone jumps on the charity bandwagon. Oprah's Australian adventure rakes in the viewers. And Australia's biggest publisher goes carbon neutral. So we turn to our guest for today, Tim Parker, a man with a big portfolio and many titles. I saw a press release come through earlier this week in which you were the chairman of Porta Novelli, which obviously is part of the Clemenger Group as well. Let's maybe just talk about the bits of the Clemenger Group that come within your responsibilities first of all.
Sure. The way the group's structured, fundamentally, we have the mainstream advertising agencies, which people will be aware of, mainly led by BBDO. And then we have what we call our diversified marketing services group, which is anything up to it's a couple of dozen companies, which cover the waterfront of marketing communications. And that's essentially the division that I head up.
And what's taking your time the most at the moment? Where are you seeing the growth or where are you putting in management time?
Well, there's probably three key areas right now. One of which we've really just had a major coup in, which is in the healthcare area. We launched at the end of last year Ursa Clemenger by acquiring the Ursa Independent Healthcare Unit. That's terrific. That's been a strategic priority for us because we see healthcare as a very, very broad field.
And you had CJB before.
We had CJB health. And we merged them into Ursa to form Ursa Clemenger. So, we've now got probably the best part of 50 or 60 people.
And then you acquired another small health company.
We did indeed, yes. We were actually approached by Renard, which run by a chap called Neil Fox, hence the Renard. French is up to it, and he had some great client relationships, and he suggested that they would also be a very good strategic fit, and so we've brought them into the fold too. So yes, we've created what you generously called a super agency in the healthcare area.
Oh, I did. Yes, that's right. Yes, the healthcare super agency. Yes,
that's right. But it's a very, very broad field, and it ranges from the real hardcore pharmaceutical stuff right through to the very broad area of health and fitness and functional foods and well-being. And all such things, which are very much order of the day.
And it's a sort of hidden little industry that actually is, there's big money to be made from it as well. I mean, I used to edit a magazine called Hospital Doctor, and just the sheer quality of production you would see in the ads aimed at doctors, for instance, implied that there were big clients there with big amounts of money to spend to promote the right products.
There are, but they're also very, very constrained by legislation and regulations. So finding your way through that minefield is extremely difficult. Also, you've got a situation where the large pharmaceutical companies are finding life very difficult at the moment because a lot of their pipelines are drying up. A lot of their products that they've had that have been rivers of gold are now turning to generics. So they are really searching for what's next.
And by generics, that's kind of when they go off patent number of years, which means that the cheaper kind of drugs come through. So there's no point promoting those to the doctors in the same way.
That's exactly right. So you find a very, very abrupt end to a revenue stream, which can be a very damaging thing. So we're seeing that also as a threat to our interest in that business, so that you can't rely on the pharma business in the way historically we have.
I think people said 2012 is the year where a lot of stuff goes off patent, isn't it?
That's exactly right.
So is this the time to be getting into health?
It's the time to be getting into a different part of health, and that's why we were very heavily with CJB, probably 70% reliant on the pharmaceutical industry. That 70% is now probably down to about 30 or 40% because we now have much more interest in the OTC area, the lifestyle
and the
broader lifestyle areas that health represent.
And I suppose the other thing as well is certainly, it's a few years since I really wrote about it, but one of the trends I was seeing was when the marketing budgets, they were shifting from pure advertising to what we described as education, whether it was training, courses, or events that connected with doctors one-on-one. Does the business have a foot in that sort of camp as well?
The medical education side is very important. That whole area was, again, very, very restricted about 2 years ago when you were essentially forbidden from the sorts of incentives, shall we call them, generously.
There were some very hospitable hospitality.
Yeah, a lot of conferences happened in Switzerland in the winter and so on and so forth. So all of that sort of stuff came to a halt. But the medical education side is a very big area and it's one that we'll still be interested in.
Okay, what about the rest of the group?
Well, it's probably an area that was really challenging us at the moment, and positively challenging us, is what is now very broadly being called shopper marketing. It's interesting how this term is really sort of bubbling to the fore. It's been around in the States for a while. I think it was accelerated by the fact that P&G appointed their head of shopper marketing to be the worldwide head of marketing. So everybody sort of went, we better find out what this shopper marketing thing is.
And this is more than just point of sale.
This is a lot more. It's indicative. Next month or the week, month after, I believe, there's an event, the shopper marketing event, and there's a call for speakers out at the moment, and there are 21 subject areas that you could possibly speak in. Now, that says to me that this is an area that perhaps is rather ill-defined. People are making it mean what they like, but we have a very strong player in that space in creative activation, which is essentially a field marketing business and a sales promotion business. So we're very used to the idea of operating at the point of sale, making the point of sale work, staff training, and then mystery shopping. So you have a virtuous
circle. And the agency's name is?
Creative Activation. And it's actually one of the biggest players in our group, but it's probably one of the least known, partly because of what they do is not the high-profile public stuff that you'd see on TV and so on. It's the in-store stuff. It's the staff training, and it's making sure that the shopping experience is as good as it can be. All of a sudden, that is right at the top of people's radar because so many decisions are now being made at the point of sale. So many different spheres of influence are creeping into the shopping process. Advertising's role is still there, but it's perhaps diminishing in favour of recommendations and so on and so forth. So shopper marketing, just influencing the way that people actually go out and buy the stuff, is a major area. And we believe that that is a ground that we are in a very, very good position to capitalise on and take ownership and leadership in.
And does this focus particularly in FMCG, for instance?
Fast-moving
consumer goods.
Packaged goods would be actually a relatively small part of the portfolio, although having said that, we've just made there's been a couple of major new business wins, which we'll be announcing very soon in the packaged goods space. I'd love to, Tim, but that would probably be inappropriate. But that will propel us into the grocery space in a way that we've hitherto not been. We've been much more working in, certainly in telco. We do a great deal of work with Optus, which is from their sales promotions point of sale. We train the staff on the sales promotions, and then we send the mystery shoppers in to make sure they're doing it properly. We make sure that all the point of sale material is displayed properly and so on and so forth. We also do a lot of work for Sony and many other brands. We wouldn't necessarily know that it was our people doing the work. Quite often we're wearing the logo of the brand concerned. So, but there are people trained by us to that client's very strict guidelines.
And you find sometimes as well that this relationship with particular specific brands, maybe with one of these companies, could it then actually bring in a relationship to the wider group as well?
It could do. The Clemenger Group was not constructed for that purpose. It's interesting. We simply wanted to have the best collection of industry-leading businesses that we could possibly get. The idea of them collaborating and in the way that some other companies have set up themselves is
some
not
other companies
quite,
called Photon.
Or SDW, even. We've not actually set it up like that deliberately. However, clearly, we'd be stupid if we didn't see the opportunity to broaden our footprint with our clients, not necessarily just to our benefit, but to their benefit, because the type of ideas that we're trying to drive now require, in fact, they demand multiple channels. And that probably brings me to the third area of interest, which is the public relations space. We have significant interest in that area. We have Porta Novelli, which is a fairly well-known and consumer-focused business. We have a business called Causeway, which is more in the area of business consultancy. And then we have Government Relations Australia, which is, as its name suggests, helping people to connect with government. So we cover that area very well. And with Porta Novelli, we see a major opportunity to build the type of PR business we need now. Again, back to P&G, the head of P&G recently said the time of PR is now, because he absolutely understands how important influencing consumer conversations is to the whole new world that we live in, and that the diminishing influence of manufacturers, whether it's their advertising or their websites, in favour of the people who are now really leading those conversations and giving the advice that people seek, that's historically what PR has always done. So it's now got to work out how it does it in the future.
I guess this is a good point to bring in Scott with your PR background. Is that a picture that you would agree with?
Yeah, that's what I've been seeing that for a while now, that I think PR's always been the communication specialists, and that's the arena that everybody's playing in now, you know, the written word, so to speak, online. I think, you know, so it's one of those, I read an article the other day about, I saw a big argument on Twitter where everybody was arguing about who owns social media. And, you know, ultimately, it should, I've always felt like it should come under public relations and the communications. A lot of times I've seen advertising try and run it, and they're coming up from a different angle where they've been shouting for 40 years at people and not actually listening a lot of the time. So I think that's where we're seeing that PR really needs to lead it, because we've always been that influence, you know, that underlying influence, I guess. And I think that's where it's needed more than ever.
And Tim, I mean, I almost wonder whether the future of your good PR agency is one that actually folds in both word of mouth and social media all under one roof.
I think if you're not doing that already, you're probably not in the game. I think the bigger challenge, and I think Scott's put it very well, historically the people who have led a lot of the client relationships, by which I guess I mean the ad agencies, haven't really understood that space well. And one of the things that we've done here in Sydney is we've actually moved Pordenham Valley, for instance, into our into St Leonard's HQ, so that they are in the same building as BBDO. And lo and behold, you know, within months they're starting to work together. We're starting to see people sitting having cups of coffees and talking about issues. They are starting to be brought in much earlier in the process, rather than getting that call the night before the pitch. Can you PR this, please? Which is historically, you know, how it has been. So, and I think there's a lot more respect. I had a great conversation with Nick Worthington, who's the creative director at Colenso, probably one of the best creative directors in the world, and certainly one of the most awarded. And he is absolutely crying out for a great relationships with good PR people, because he absolutely respects the way that they handle conversations. And as Scott says, the respect they have for the consumers that they're dealing with and the way that they propel those messages is vital to him and his team's ideas getting out there in the right manner.
And yet, I can't think of many agencies in Australia or arguably in the world that do it that well, where an advertising agency with a big brief and a big idea genuinely integrates PR professionals right from the beginning.
It's tough, I've got to admit. I mean, it's one of the struggles that I've faced in all my time as in working in PR, that, you know, no matter, I've worked with numerous brands, you know, and a lot of the time, yeah, we get called in at the last minute, and it's this whole, here's a brief. There was one case, I can't name the company involved, where we constantly were not given the brief for the next year. And, you know, eventually we had the market manager say, where the hell is this PR plan? And we were saying, well, we haven't had the brief yet. I mean, how do we know how we can help you with PR when the advertising company's not even given us anything yet?
And was this a fellow... Fleischmann Hillard is an Omnicom agency?
Yes, this isn't when I was at Fleischmann. Okay. It's a previous agency. But it is a struggle.
Do you find yourself working with fellow Omnicom agencies?
We worked... for one of our stuff, we were working with... obviously, we're based in the same building as Wyben TBWA Tequila. So we've worked with them on a few things. And you know, you find that I was talking last week with the US at a pitch we were working on, and they were getting another one of the Omnicom agencies involved at the time to try and work on it. So yeah, we do get involved in some cases, I guess, but a lot of the time it's, you know, it depends on who the client has as the ad agency and as the PR agency.
I mean, I almost wonder, and this is massively unfair generalisation, but I'm going to make it anyway. Advertising people, sort of, and creatives, on the whole, don't seem to have a understanding at all of how PR works. You know, they're so used to being able to buy the space and give their message. And I just wonder whether the modern successful creative is the person who can really understand how they can multiply their message through free media with all descriptions. You know, whether PR actually will have to be part of what a creative knows and understands.
They are absolutely, and that's absolutely true. And if you look at the Titaniums that are being won at Cannes, the smart creative people realise that in spades. I mean, the stuff that we did for Yellow Pages in New Zealand with the Treehouse restaurant or whatever, that was just a great idea.
It's propelled worth explaining into the media. For people who don't know.
Yeah, I mean,
that.
It's essentially Yellow Pages, Yellow, as they're called in New Zealand, came to Colenso and said, look, you know, we need to encourage people to understand that we still exist, that Google's not everything in this world, and that Yellow have a role. So rather than just go out and do some TV ads, what we did was we said, OK, we'll prove that Yellow can help someone achieve something extraordinary. And after a little recruitment campaign, we found a girl whose name, I believe, was Tracy. She was about 24, 25-year-old. I think she's an architecture student. And the brief to her was to build a restaurant in a tree. And all she could use was Yellow Pages. She could only use people who she found in Yellow Pages. We gave her a caravan, a mobile phone, and the Yellow Pages, and off she went. And there's a fantastic video on YouTube, which I'm sure people can find if they were to Google it. It explains how it happens. And essentially, it became press ads that said how she was getting on and on that. But they were very much playing a support role to what was really just a great idea. And the media picked up on it big time. You know, it became the lead item on news. It may say something about news in New Zealand, I don't know. But it was just terrific. And it just said everything you wanted to say about Yellow. But that was just a really great idea propelled out into the media space. Because someone just realised that it was the idea that was important and not necessarily the vehicle. And they work very closely with the people. And it's no coincidence that Nick Worthington, who I was talking about earlier, was the guy driving that. So he very much saw what happened and the benefits of it.
Tim, how do you find them? I mean, obviously the old adage was that PR was 10% of the overall marketing budget. I think that's what we used to hear. But nowadays, I mean, I guess I've seen a lot of campaigns where advertising gets this multi-million dollar chunk, and then the media spends a multi-million dollar chunk, and then the actual PR campaign, they walk up and they give them like 50,000 and say, that's what we're going to do for the PR, which seems obviously very different and price difference for what you're kind of getting, I guess.
I don't know how clients go about splitting their budgets because they're all different. But I think more and more they're seeing them holistically, which is good. And I think some of the old divisions between them, particularly in the PR space, because PR tended to be the area of people in very suited area of corporate communications, which was often very close to the CEO's heart because it was clearly often the way that he was viewed. But I think moving that more into the marketing sphere, I think, is a healthy thing. It's not unlike direct marketing was, I think, 10 years ago. And your point about the way that ad agencies perceive PR is exactly what you could say about direct marketing. In Sydney, we overcame that by putting a DM guy, Andy Pontin, in charge of BBDO, which was quite a shock to the industry at the time. And yet you look at what's happening in Sydney right now, they would be one of the most integrated operations that there are because they've got someone at the helm who actually gets it and has been on the other side of the fence.
Yeah.
And you've just announced a bit of a revamp for Porter & Novelli, new logo. I presume things go beyond that. The press release talked to the concepts of transformation, intelligence, and industry leadership. Is this something that sort of, you know, come from the US and you have to roll out the local thing? Or?
The answer to your question is yes, it has come from the US. We have the benefit of having worked with Interbrand, another sister agency who did a bit of barter work for them in the States. And yeah, it's a refresh, and I'm not going to pretend that it's anything much more than that. But it is a great opportunity from an internal perspective, from a staff perspective, to see themselves being portrayed in a new light. It looks better. It comes up better. And it also perhaps just sends out a clarion call that this industry, that the business is changing as the industry is. So really that's very much how we're treating it, as just a really good chance to refresh the brand and take a good hard look at it and think of the sort of, you know, the things that we need to be doing, the sort of people we need to be attracting, who will also be, I suspect, some quite different people. So, yeah, it's a new era.
And for you, this coming year, what are your priorities? Where do you expect to be spending most time?
I suspect that this PR area will be one of them, because as we're reforming that, there's a lot of opportunity there, and there's still a lot of work to be done in bringing them together.
How big is the agency, by the way? How many people?
We have operations in Melbourne and Sydney. We have about 25 people in each part. So it's actually quite strong having, you know, what is, you know, okay, it's Melbourne and Sydney, but it's as close to a national presence as you're going to get. I think we'll be trying to leverage that as well, because I think there will be a number of clients who can do that. And surprisingly, we don't have any of that. The other surprising thing is we don't have a single client as a consequence of being part of the global network of Porter & Novelli. Now, although we at Clemenger Group pride ourselves in the fact that, you know, we eat what we kill locally, should we say, and only probably, you know, I don't know, 15% of our revenues come out of overseas businesses, it would be nice to have a bit more of that. So I may well be, especially with the new ownership arrangement with Omnicom, where, you know, they've now taken a majority, we'll probably be just paying a little bit more attention to what opportunities there are out there.
Well, before we get into the week's topics, the one other thing I did want to ask you about was I looked you up on LinkedIn earlier on, and a former colleague of yours called Seymour spoke very well of you on LinkedIn, but pointed out that you don't give very kind LinkedIn recommendations yourself. So I went to Seymour's profile to see you describe him as, Seymour was an astonishingly, almost surreally bad at Kent exec, Jack, who plumbed new depths of untimeliness and inattention to detail. But he's still a mate after 25 years, which must mean something. Which seems a tad harsh on a former friend.
To point out, he is also probably a billionaire. So if you understood the context of his success, I don't think that his failure at Ogilvy and Mather London in 1984 held him back. But no, I couldn't resist the plug.
Excellent. Well, next, the competitive world of Sydney Radio.
Hi, it's Andrew and Claire here, and we're standing outside the front door of what could be your brand new wisdom home here at Gregory Hills.
That's right. We're giving away an entire house and land package worth over $500,000.
Like the whole thing. I'm giving it away.
So what are we doing out the front? Why don't you come inside? We'll show you your new pad.
ARN's radio station Mix 106.5 in Sydney has, I suppose, raised the bar in radio giveaways, certainly in value terms. To promote its new breakfast team of Andrew Rochford? Any Rochford? Idea? And Claire Hooper. You'll know Andrew as the clever one who pops up on the 7pm project sometimes. The station has launched The Great Australian Dream, which sees a $500,000 dream home up for grabs out in Sydney's suburbs. Scott, I guess firstly, good promotion? Is there some
good
PR
prize
around that?
You know, good prize, good to push out. But I suppose one of the problems is that you're limited to, and if you're part of a radio station, is that you've only got one radio station to push it out with. So, you know, you've got to then start pushing out elsewhere, I guess, and that's where the problems come in, because you're a media agency yourself trying to push a promotion when nobody else wants to run it, because you know, a lot of your rivals are out there. It's a good prize. Terrible video. I mean, absolutely atrocious.
Yeah, we played just before this conversation, obviously, a few seconds of the video, or rather, we will have edited it in by the time the listeners are listening to it. In fairness, that was just a video to sit on the website, so it wasn't
doesn't matter.
A 30-second TV ad.
Yeah, it doesn't matter where it is. It's you know, every company's a publisher these days, and you know you have to put something of quality to your name. And I think it's dreadful, to be perfectly honest. It feels like an infomercial.
Well, Tim, let me sort of almost put this to you as a marketing problem. So you're a radio station. It's a massively competitive market. Obviously, we've got Austereo with Carl and Jackie, number one by a long way. You've got a new lineup. You've got to do something to get people to sample your product for the first time. What would you do if the station was your client? What would you recommend to them?
Well, I think I'd look at what's happening in radio broadly, which is, to me, it's more about the emergence of talent than it is about the emergence of radio brands. And if you look around at what's been successful, whether it's Hamish and Andy or Kyle and Jackie, that's about talent. I wouldn't be recommending that they do something which shows their talent in such a dreadful light. I mean, by all means, pull people in, by all means, get them to sample it. But to me, if it's about the talent, that is not, I'm not the target audience, but that I don't think is doing their talent any favours at all.
What are your radio listening habits, by the way? What do you, or your media consumption
I'm very,
habits?
I'm very ABC, I'm afraid, yes.
ABC but, National in the morning?
Actually, news radio, big fan.
Yeah, so you can get the World Service overnight as well.
Here's something that's happened outside of Australia.
And what about other media? Are you much of a TV watcher?
I wouldn't say our household would be heavy TV watchers, but we consume all the sort of media that expect with a household with two adults and a seven-year-old child in it. The seven-year-old is probably more of an ABC seven-year-old than any other sort, but she can recite the Bunnings jingle from top to bottom as well, so it just shows that we must have some variety.
What would you pick as your favourite sort of a piece of Australian television?
I'd have to go for Rake. I think that was an outstanding piece of television that was, obviously ABC, so I'm not talking from a commercial perspective, but I thought that was absolutely outstanding. I thought it was great writing. I thought it was extremely well produced.
Magazines? Do you ever buy a magazine these days?
Magazines, I would say no. I would rely much more online. I mean, there are plenty of magazines coming to our household. Not many of them cross my desk. In a previous life, I was a big reader of the football magazines.
442,
obviously, 442. I have to say, but I think that's the way that that's lost its way a little bit lately because of the, I think, the sheer lack of product that they've got to talk about.
Although they won Magazine of the Year, actually, back in November with the local magazine.
Well, I'm delighted to hear it because all praise to the guys for getting it off the ground, and I know what an uphill slog it was for them. But, you know, I just don't think that the way that the game is going at the moment is doing them any favours.
No, it's funny. I was watching some football the weekend, and I think it was Melbourne playing. I can't remember who they were playing, and I switched over to La Liga. Just I pressed up once, and next thing you know, I was like, I cannot believe the difference in speed and gameplay and everything.
So you were the CEO of Sydney FC. I think the season that the A-League started,
the inaugural season. Yeah.
Was there a skills gap?
Look, I was. The first thing I always said when I went there was I was not there for the football. I know that sounds ridiculous, but I was brought in because they recognised, I think rather late in the day, that what they were doing was launching a brand and that they needed to apply some very strong marketing disciplines to build a community around that brand with deep connection to it that would make the thing commercially viable. And the agreement that I had with Pierre Littbarski, who was then the coach, was very similar to the one that I had with my creative director at my previous agency when I was running FCB. It was, look, I won't tell you how to run a football club or a football team, but when I need, you know, when I tell you that I need you or the players to step up for appearances or whatever, you've just got to trust me that that's what I need from you. Otherwise, I just created the environment for them to do their job. And we had a hugely successful season. We were averaging 19,000 people at the Footy Stadium, or Aussie Stadium as it was then, and in the first season. And as it happens, we won the championship, and all was good. It's been, personally, I find it quite distressing and disappointing to see what's happened since then. And I'm not in any way putting myself up to the credit of it. It cost us a great deal of money that first season, and in some ways, you say you lost a lot of money. Actually, it was money invested in a great brand, and I think that's been frittered away.
Mm. Would you ever go back to that sort of industry, do you think?
Absolutely not.
Really?
No. I find it strange. I think, come from the UK, one of the difficult things I find is the time of the games. I find a Friday night football is the strangest time, because that's pub time. That's when you know, it's not time when you go to a football match.
Yeah.
It's end of the week, you've done your shift, you know, you want to go with your workmates or whatever. It's not the night I want to go see football during the day at 3 o'clock or whatever, at 1 o'clock.
We campaigned very hard to get the Sunday afternoon games, which were family games, and it became very family oriented.
Yeah.
And that was one of the fantastic things. We were getting 35% probably family attendance, which was great, and it just added a whole different dimension to the experience.
Well, up next, another big promo. So Hahn Superdry has launched a lucky bottle promo involving mobile phones hidden in beer bottles. The lucky drinker will then get to call a concierge on the phone to arrange a big $20,000 night out involving helicopters, I seem to remember. Now, personally, I quite like this idea, but it did take something of hammering on Mumbrella's comment stream. The ad to go with it in particular, which is basically, you know, it's sort of, you know, the kind of hot girl who can't open a bottle, and then the alpha male strolls up, and but then turns out that he can't open it, and then it turns out because it's got a phone hidden in it. Tim, do you like the campaign? Do you see it as doing the job?
Oh, look, I'm putting aside the sheer disappointment of finding a phone in a bottle instead of beer. I would say, I mean, it's probably quite an exciting and interesting thing. I suspect the comments that it got, the negative comments, were the fact that it's been done before. It was done famously for Coke by the same agency from some years ago. But so what? I mean, it's still a good idea. I'm not sure that they're doing it much justice in the way they're promoting it, because I think I'd perhaps be, you know, talking more about what you can get out of it rather than how it happens. But there is a certain amount of excitement and novelty around it. The fact that it isn't an original idea, the only thing I'd say is that I'm not sure what that's doing for the brand itself. I mean, it does feel like a little bit of a copycat idea rather than something that's pushing the brand forward. But maybe that's not part of the brand profile.
Well, this is one of the questions as well, isn't it? I know there's, you know, we write about it as well, but there's this obsession with everything being new and original and calling out the copycats. To the client, do they care if something's been done sometime?
Not if it sells beer, not at all.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. As long as it works, what does it matter? I mean, there's so many things just rejigged and rehashed that gets pushed out there that, you know, it's going to happen more and more. I like that personally. I drink the beer anyway, so I do have a connection with it. I think it's a good taste. And the ad itself, it does the job, I think, but I'd like to see the T's and C's to see what you can spend the 20 grand on. I think that would be interesting. Because if somebody's missed that point out, it'd be interesting to see somebody like, right, give me Coke and hookers, please.
Well, next we talk about Vodafone's ongoing image problems. So timing is everything. So when Vodafone launched this year's World of Difference campaign, which pays for consumers to work for their favourite charity for a year, there was a little bit of a backlash. Basically, network problems are creating unhappy customers at the moment. This particular case, it's part of a national, international campaign. This is the national component of it. So I'm guessing that from Vodafone's point of view, they've got to do this. I guess their problem at the moment is they're in the papers are full of sort of privacy breaches of customer databases. They've obviously got a much wider problem or perception problem over connectivity problems. What's good strategy in that sort of situation, Tim? Because presumably you can't just stop advertising, you know, while you sort out your other problems.
No, you clearly can't do that. And I think that there's a certain assumption that this is a cynical response to try and paper over some cracks. It can't be. This thing's got a life overseas. You know, it's a well-known and well-established part of the Vodafone brand globally. And all credit for them for doing it. So I think, you know, to some extent, with stuff like this, you almost have to carry on regardless and just, you know, stick to your core of what you're trying to do. But for God's sake, make it absolutely clear that you are listening to and you are hearing, most importantly, what's being said and what's going on in the broader world, and that you're doing something about it. Because otherwise, this will be, you know, it will be assumed that this is just trying to paper over cracks.
Yeah, I mean, the crisis strategy on a lot of things lately has been, you know, I find it a bit strange at times. I feel like they should be out there, you know, straight away defending the net, or at least being honest as much as possible. When the whole SMH article came out with Ashton Moses, where he's basically said that, you know, all these dealers are phoning up and we're changing people's, posing as customers and changing their contracts just to get kickbacks and stuff. I mean, that's, you know, I've not seen a lot of their responses on
that.
Now,
in fairness to Vodafone, one of the franchises that was accused of some inappropriate behaviour has, the Herald then reported a couple of days later that Vodafone had ended the relationship. So to that point of view, they obviously did respond.
Yeah.
But there is a bigger issue. You know, for instance, right now, you know, we're making business decisions about, you know, our providers as contracts come to the end.
Yeah.
And because of, you know, I speak as a business consumer here, I've formed the view that we can't consider Vodafone as a provider, you know, because their reputation is so poor for service at the moment. Right. You know, and that's based on what I've read in the papers, basically.
Yeah. The brand damage, and this will keep going with this lawsuit going. This is just going to keep rolling and rolling and rolling. So, you know, I think the best thing to do is just throw a lot of money at their infrastructure and say, look, we're actually trying to repair it. We're trying to fix what's happening. You've told us there's a problem. We're going to fix this problem.
Well, this is the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. For more on all of these stories, head to mumbrella.com.au. Next, we talk summer TV ratings. So it's a summer of cricket and Oprah, according to the ratings, with the Ashes Test coming in at number one, or at least one of the sessions, number one on the most watched table. Oprah was the other big ratings phenomenon. Now, of course, we always have this this sort of slightly weird ratings period where the summer coincides with Christmas and non-normal programming. So there's this period where the networks don't compete so hard with each other, and you know, it's almost not counted as the ratings, although they do ratings. So yeah, so just looking through our numbers, in fact, I'll correct myself as well. It wasn't actually the test. It was one of the one game. It was the second session of the first day, the one day cricket, which pulled in just over 2.5, nearly 2.6 million average viewers. Oprah's Ultimate Australian Adventure Part 1 was number two during the summer top 40, 2.4 million. The next episode, then with just under 2.2 million, was third. Then an episode of Glee, then a couple of 2020, and so on down. So as you look through the whole top 20, it very much looks like cricket and Oprah.
Yeah, it does, actually. It's funny. It made me realise. It's funny because I picked up a paper on Tuesday. I was looking through it, and I just looked and I went, this is just sport. This entire newspaper is virtually sport. There's hardly any news. It's sport everywhere. And then just you kind of sum up. I mean, honestly, the Australian population loves sport. It's as simple as that. And everybody wanted to see Oprah because it highlighted the country. And I think the ratings kind of spoke for themselves. There wasn't really much else on, apart from obviously Glee.
Glee, and not much from the ABC, actually.
No, I noticed that.
But your ABC usually spikes about 1 million viewers for most of those shows anyway.
No, that's true, yeah. So, and I suppose you were probably out on the deck, so...
I think the thing about the Oprah thing, I mean, the ratings are going to be really interesting, are the ones that come in from where it's shown elsewhere.
Yes.
That will be fascinating because that's obviously the point of it. I mean, she's obviously going to... She'll win here because Australians love to hear themselves being talked about on the world stage and a bit of acknowledgement from overseas and all that, and that's been worked over many times. Fundamentally, I think it's a great idea, but I mean, what do they do next with it is the important thing. Yeah. It's interesting. I was thinking about this in the context. You may remember a campaign with Daryl Summers for the Northern Territory. You'll never, never know if you never, never go. Now, not often you hear Daryl compared with Oprah, but similar sort of thing. We take a city slicker, we put them somewhere that people think is inaccessible and dangerous and inhospitable, and they have a great time. But the reason that campaign worked is because they had a retail tale that followed it up, and there were lots of offers and there were lots of bundles to get you there safely and quickly and have a nice time and get you back again and all this sort of stuff. I want to know where that work is, because just building the brand equity, which is what this is doing, won't be anywhere near enough.
It's funny, there was an article saying that somebody was going to be suing Tourism Australia or something because they came up with the Oprah idea first years ago or something.
That felt like one of those flimsy online stories that fell over as soon as you got beyond the third paragraph.
Yeah, that's what I thought as well. The one thing that reminded me of this is the fact that I think a lot of time it's right place, right time if you're pitching in an idea like that. You know, if you've got to be the person that goes, well, you've got to have the right contacts. You know, it's one of those things. You've got kind of all the moons have to align at the same time type thing to get the actual thing kicked off.
Well, next and finally, News Limited goes green. So Australia's biggest publisher, News Limited, has announced that it is now carbon neutral following the launch of its One Degree project. In 2007, the company reduced its carbon emissions by 18.4% in 2010 and reckons that when the final auditing is done, then by the end of the calendar year, so the end of last month, it reached its goal of 20%. Tim, what's Clemenger Group's stance on sustainability? Have you got a kind of board level policy on how the company should behave? Are you good corporate citizens?
It certainly doesn't involve wind farms in Turkey, which the News Limited one seems to do.
That's where they're buying their offsets.
It's one of the all-time greats. I thought that was just
marvellous. They just bought Turkey and then just put the wind farms on
exactly
the trees.
Right. But no, I mean, it's, you know, we have, as you'd expect, a sort of, you know, a corporate social relations responsibility package. It consists of individual offices doing what they can on this type of front. I mean, you go through our offices at night and hopefully everyone's turned off their computers and the lights are all on special switches, and you know, the gents only lights up when you go in there, which can be a bit frightening if you're in there for too long. we do our stuff. We also launched a couple of years ago, which is essentially the Clemenger Staff Fund, which is a foundation whereby we match dollar for dollar staff giving, so that we're able to do some stuff that, you know, we put some stuff back into the community, ours and elsewhere. And that's just a way of getting in staff very much engaged in this sort of area. It's an important thing. I'm not sure I'd be shouting about it from the rooftops in the way that they are. I think these things are better off when you just do them rather than tell people you're doing them. But I'm sure they have their reasons. I mean, to me, the news thing looked much more like a cost-cutting exercise than anything else. You know, fewer people flying places, less money. You know.
Journalists stuck to their desks.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose the other question for me is also the fact that the way they reached them was by buying offsets as well. So in other words, there's argument, do what you want, but then so long as you've planted some trees or your money's been invested in a wind farm in Turkey, then that's okay.
Turkey needs the money, let's be honest.
Yeah, but I suppose the one thing I did kind of think, where again, you know, lots of people thought they were the funniest person in the world when they commented, oh, you know, makes up for all the hot air there, Andrew Bolt spouts, etc. Is better than they do it than they don't.
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, every company should be doing it. That's a key at the moment.
Fleischmann Hillard?
We double print, we double side printing and stuff. We try and send the least amount of paper documents as we can, I guess, and lights are off, computers are off, you know, everything like that. I think it's important that we all do our bit.
I heard a wonderful initiative the other day, it's a form of attachment that you can't print.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so nice. it's like a PDF. I forget the name of it now, which I shouldn't because it's a very clever name as well. But it's essentially, it's a PDF attachment that it's impossible to print out. Which
well,
I thought was...
Unless you print screen.
Really nice. Well, yeah, I'm sure there's a way around.
Well, that is all that we have time for today. Thank you as ever to my co-host, Scott Rohde.
Thanks, Tim.
And to our guest, Tim Parker.
Thanks, Tim.
And also to CBS Interactive for use of their studio. Production was by Georgina Pearson. For these stories and more, head to mumbrella.com.au. That was the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrow.